Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
All righty, hello everyone, and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a really exciting founder with us, you know, a founder that has been there, done it, you know, really amazing, you know, the rocket ship that they're in. They've raised now a lot of money. I mean, 180 million. They've done like 9 acquisitions, going from A to E, you name it. I find that thinking about, you know, how to go about those acquisitions, thinking about attitude, also the routine that he goes through, we're going to talk about that. Not following others, you know, and having that combination of humility and confidence, you know, being key. But again, you know, I find that the conversation today is going to be quite inspiring. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Paul Wilshire. Welcome to the show.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me today.
So originally from Australia, give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up over there?
Well, it was very different to living here in America. I was born in New York, but my family were from England and we moved back to Australia when I was very young. Now, growing up in Australia, it was a small town and I went to a humble high school. It was a little rough at times. You know, I had to get a little street smart at school and, you know, it was the 80s, so things were different. But you know, I love and respect every part of my history because it teaches you lessons that you need to learn.
So in your case, how do you get into music? Because obviously music has been pivotal, you know, in your life. And how did you start to develop the love for music?
You know, I discovered music very early. I think I just found a piano in someone's house and it was an affair. You know, I couldn't keep myself away from instruments. So I learned trumpet when I was, I think, in seventh grade, right through to 12th grade. And I discovered synthesizers when I was 16. And I got my first synthesizer when I was 16. And that really changed my life. You know, being able to really use electronics to create sound was really the genesis of a great music production career that ensued after that.
I mean, and quite a success there too. I mean, you were producing for the likes of the Backstreet Boys. So how was that, you know, being a producer and how was that journey like?
It was a wonderful journey. It was about 20 years in total. So my producing and songwriting career began in the mid-90s and I spent many years just in a studio working with, you know, the platform is called today Logic Audio, and mixing consoles and equipment and working with musicians, recording music, playing music. I was very hands-on. I liked doing everything from creating the sounds to playing in the music to recording every piece and then mixing. And it was a time where you constantly had the benefit of completion, you know, creating a product, finishing it, seeing it released, and enjoying that. It's something that I think as an entrepreneur is very hard to feel because it feels like when you're growing a business, it's never ending. There's never that sort of finishing point, I guess, when you exit finally. But I miss the euphoria of finishing projects that music production gave me.
So obviously on the music production, I mean, you were there for quite a long time. I mean, we're talking like you were talking about 2 decades, you know, there. So it's incredible how all of a sudden you decided to shift gears and how in 2014, for example, you know, is when you took a different route when it came to your path, to your career, to everything that you knew. So what caused that shift? And you know, it's interesting because they say that ideas, you know, they're like dormant, you know, they take time to incubate. So in your case, what was that incubation like? And what was that triggering point where you said, wow, I think I'm going to go and do this thing that I have no idea what it's going to look like, but I'll take a step at it.
Well, I think it was gradual. I was always interested in business. And although I very much wore a creative hat day to day as a record producer and songwriter, I was always thinking about the business. I very much studied the music business. and I really got to understand music rights. And music rights are fascinating because of just how fragmented the music industry is. It really started out as an industry that sold CDs or vinyl cassettes and was very regionalized. And when the digital age came, it became very global instantly, and the ecosystem just wasn't ready for it. So I think what was really eating away at me while I was in the studio creating was there's a really big problem to solve in the music industry. And I could see how quickly the transition to the current reality, I guess we're in today, was happening digitally. Everything was moving very quickly. There was more and more musicians getting access to tools to be able to create music on the supply side, and on the demand side, there was more and more use of music. And so I think what really happened, it was a gradual realization, something I was thinking about day in and day out, and where I think I needed to develop enough confidence to go, I can solve this. I'm going to make a big move and you know, move away from what was, you know, quiet town of Melbourne in Australia to sort of, or somewhat naively, move over to Los Angeles with the belief that we could do it. And I knew that there was the problem to solve. That I was clear about. And I guess that journey into being commercial as well as creative was one that was gradual over the many years I was in there. And you had to be quite commercial to be successful as a record producer. I mean, it's not just about creativity. There's a lot of hustle involved.
So I guess then for the company, for SongTrader, what ended up being the business model? You know, how do you guys make money?
So we license music, we license technology, and as a result of our recent acquisition, we also sell music to consumers. The premise of the business model is that we take a share of the money that ultimately goes to artists, labels, publishers, so the supply side of the industry. The demand side of the industry is B2B and B2C for us. So B2B being advertisers, film, TV, games, apps, platforms, anyone who uses music in a commercial or digital business environment. And we have an enormous consumer audience on the platform Bandcamp we recently acquired. There's about 50 million people that use that platform, that use it to discover new artists and buy music from them, buy products, merchandise, vinyl, t-shirts, as well as digital music.
Do you remember that moment where you felt, wow, I think we're into something here?
Yes. It was actually quite early on when we first launched SongTrader. And this was the early days, I think, too, for sort of online, like social media advertising using Facebook and platforms like that to advertise. And we hit this point where someone was signing up, an artist was signing up to our platform every couple of minutes. And we really felt like, oh, this is actually working. Like we're getting real traction. Building a two-sided marketplace is quite challenging because the dynamics of, you know, of you need supply in order to have an, you know, be able to serve demand, is we discovered was not exactly how our, I guess, flywheel worked. And it was really more about growing demand that stimulated more supply. But that was a very difficult balance to achieve in the early days. But yeah, answering the question in brief, it was around 2016 when we saw thousands, tens of thousands of artists signing up to our platform.
So how did you go about to the financing of the business? Because, I mean, you guys have raised quite a bit, you know, $180 million. So how has it been to the journey of capitalizing the business and making sure that you were able to support the growth?
So we've always had a philosophy of only raise what you need. I think the mistake sometimes that can be made is you go out and raise too much. You make big mistakes. And we found that we only, in the early days, we raised just enough to get us through to that sort of next milestone, that next point of proof. And we are fortunate enough to have traction along the way, which helped us gain a very supportive investor base. Many of our investors have invested in multiple times, three and four times. And we also expanded our strategy to include M&A, not for any kind of roll-up reason. It was really talking to the fragmentation that exists in the music business, in that there were a number of mature but isolated businesses that, when combined with our core platform and business model, really created a very valuable accretive effect. And we approached the following years accordingly. It's like we felt that the industry is moving faster and faster, which means we have to move faster, faster than organic growth without the stimulus of extra capital and using M&A to really expand the business. We've done, since 2019, about 9 transactions where we've acquired very key pieces of what we really see as a broader puzzle to be where we are today. And we're not done yet. We still see so much opportunity ahead of us, and bigger, chunkier challenges ahead of us. But the momentum's there now to support that growth, and we feel like we're on the right path. After plenty of times where you think you've got something nailed, you think you've got the right product idea, but you have to face up that you didn't get that one right, and you need to correct course.
Well, as they say, 90% of acquisitions fail because of the integration, right? The integration is really tough. And in your guys' case, you've done quite a bit, of acquisitions. I'm sure that you've learned a lot, some of them to accelerate the technology or the customer acquisition, to grow inorganically. So I guess now that you've done all these acquisitions, what have you learned from being able to do a successful acquisition, meaning that you're able to identify the right target for the right reasons, at that point for the business, and then also going about doing a successful integration too?
So there's a number of factors that lead to a successful acquisition and subsequent integration, and a lot depends on size too. So I think one factor is it a small tuck-in or is it quite a large integration? Another key factor is the target still founder-led versus has it matured to a point where there's been an exit, there's been another subsequent investor, is it PE-owned or some other framework that's gone on to own the companies beyond the founder? There's always the challenge of merging cultures. And one of the most important lenses that we look through is there a culture fit? Are we going to be able to transition this team to be part of our broader culture without too much friction? That's one very key piece, because there are times where it's just, it's chalk and cheese. It's not going to work. It's going to be too costly. It's going to be too hard. And we've walked away from opportunities in that regard. And then I think the last point is integrate fast. Don't do it slowly. Don't bring in a company and sit on it for a year or two. Integrate quickly. Have one team, one system. This is what we do. We have one product team, one technology team, one marketing team, one finance team, and one people team, et cetera. And so we integrate very quickly, and we find that is far more beneficial for a smoother integration than postponing what inevitably has to happen.
What do you mean with cultural fit? What does it look like when there is a fit or when there's not a fit?
So it can mean many things. I think you get different cultures depending on the type of business. We've bought very creative businesses and we've bought pure play technology businesses. But I think the best way to describe a fit is where there's a match or a near match of core values. And our core values are very clear. It's we really value a confident humility, for want of a better term, and transparency, honesty, being able to speak up, being able to have a voice, being able to talk freely about issues. And so if we find that there's a structure where or a team that is overconfident, overselling themselves, really presenting something that is fictional, it's an alarm bell, as an example. So there are many sort of aspects to culture fit, but generally speaking, we look for people we would like to work with, people that feel like we can be a team together, that we can be honest with each other.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard, and already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on, when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So I guess on this note, as we're talking about people, you also have distributed offices. You have people in the US, you have people in UK. And I guess how have you gone about to embracing culture when you have distributed offices? Because obviously, you know, you'll have the HQ where, you know, you're infusing there the culture, but all these different offices, they're also going to have their own culture. So how do you go about making sure that there's that alignment, that consistency?
I think you can over control, and we don't try to over control. The UK team has its own nuances. We have a big team in Amsterdam. We have a team in Australia. And we're not all practicing exactly the same sort of daily routines, but we are all using the same technology, the same communications, the same way of working, the same reporting. So I think it's really about bringing the team together so that they understand that the mission and the focus of the company, they understand what we represent. But one of the biggest important factors is integrate the teams. So we don't have, and this was actually a recent change for us, we don't have isolated reporting structures in each country, the reporting structures across country, so that the teams are actually across border. So we don't have, like, for example, just the Amsterdam team with its own reporting structure, or the English team with its own reporting structure. The structure crosses borders, and we find that has been far healthier, far more productive, and far more efficient.
Now, in your guys' case, you know, when we're thinking about culture, we're talking about investment. I wanna talk about vision, because that's something that is gonna get people excited and get them rallied and fired up. So when we're thinking about the vision here of Song Trader, imagine if you were to go to sleep tonight and you wake up in a world where the vision is fully realized. What does that world look like, Paul?
That world through our eyes looks like a music industry that has no data problems, that is paid efficiently, transparently, every dollar that is due for every piece of music that is played. And the current reality is far from that. And so we are essentially building, you know, music industry infrastructure to streamline and improve that reality. So we do see a future where that's possible, because it's all online, and the majority of the industry is online, and it's certainly becoming more so.
Now, in your case, I know that humility and confidence is a good combo. Why is that the case?
I think, you know, arrogance and insecurity is the enemy, right? So it's you that can lead to all kinds of negative effects. Why we say, you know, humbly confident, which is one of our core values, is that anyone in the team has to be humble enough to know when they have maybe could have room for improvement. And, you know, we believe in feedback between manager and employee, where the employee gets to provide feedback on the manager and vice versa. It's part of our culture to have that embedded in the relationship. But I think it's also much more valuable because everyone feels confident enough in to speak up if they've got the good idea in the room, not be afraid to be talked down because there's, you know, someone dominating the space. So we find that, you know, that combination of confidence and humility creates a much better creative and productive atmosphere, and you're more likely to build a better product as a result.
And, you know, just to double click on this, for the founders that are right now tuning in, why self-confidence and belief, you know, is so important and could be so important in their own journeys?
I spend time, a lot of time in my week on health, and I think healthy mind and, you know, exercise, meditation are crucial for clear thinking. And I think for founders, one of the things that can really destroy a business is doom loops and fear. And it's when this is not working, we need to quickly change course, or this is not working, I'm going to run out of money. If you walk in with that type of energy into a investor meeting, the investor is going to intuitively pick up that there's a problem here. There's a lack of belief. You know, there are times where, you know, things aren't going to work out, and it might be that you have a product that's just it's not going to work and it's not going to be a right fit. But I think it's very important for founders and entrepreneurs who are really big risk takers to back that risk taking mentality with a self belief and a faith in themselves. But it's not enough on its own. It needs to be accompanied with research and self-criticism in a healthy way. So, you know, what am I doing right? What am I doing wrong? What's working? What's not working? Feedback from team members, from leadership, from employees. And this is where the arrogance becomes the enemy. It's like, oh, I built this product. I need to be right. I need to make sure that the world sees me successful. These are useless thoughts. Like, you really have to be thinking, what does the customer want? What is working? What's not? It's not about you. It's about the customer. It's about the business. And I think that's where self-belief is important, but it shouldn't be projected as overconfidence. You know, it's that balance, in my view.
You were talking there about, you know, how important the state of mind and also health is to you. So walk us through, what does the typical routine or ritual, you know, for a day, you know, look like for you?
So I'm a 5 a.m. start. I will normally have a coffee in bed and read news stories, check, you know, anything that's coming overnight that's urgent, deal with that. From 6 till 8, I'll be working out. If I can fit some meditation in there, I will too. And usually my day starts around 8:30, 8:15. I work through till quite late. Most nights I'm probably working till around 7 or 8 o'clock. But I also take a 45-minute to an hour break in the afternoon where I also exercise again. I just find that gives me the fuel for sort of an afternoon evening session, and just recalibrates me after, you know, sometimes a busy and fatiguing day.
So obviously now you've been at it for quite a while with SungTrader. I mean, we're talking about, you know, over a decade here, which is like insane. You know, in imagine, you know, in compared to corporate, that would be like 100 years, right? I mean, it's amazing. So obviously a ton of lessons learned. You know, tons of ups, a tons of downs. You know, successes, lessons learned, you name it. So if I was to put you into a time machine, and let's say I was able to bring you back to 2014, to that moment where you were like, screw it, let's do it. But let's say you were able to have a sit down with that younger Paul right there on the spot, and you were able to give that younger Paul one piece of advice before launching the business. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
That's a very good question. The single piece of advice I think I would say is people are the most important part of the business, and be decisive when you know someone's not right, and focus on that right culture fit, the right person, right seat.
So let's double click on that, if you don't mind. I guess, what have you learned about people? Because, you know, especially when it comes to hyper-growth startups, I mean, there's a lot of it, you know, and in over a decade, you've probably seen a lot. So what have you learned about people?
There's so much, I don't know where to start. I think that there are often, you know, when you're growing a company, you get a lot of inbound, you know, I can help you do this. I can help you take it from here to here, you know, consultants to, you know, people just looking for their next gig and enthused by growth and enthused by where you're heading. And it's sometimes easy to be seduced by their resume and where you think that could take the business. And sometimes it works out when it's the right fit. But I think what I've really learned that it really does come down to how do they approach each day. A thick, long resume doesn't mean they're going to be working hard. It can actually sometimes mean that they're kind of tired because they've had their success. They're really looking for an easier life to benefit from their network. Whereas, you know, when you're building a startup, you need to really dig in. You need people who are going to grind. People are going to work all day and going to do that, go that to that extra level to deliver. And so I think that's one aspect. There are other aspects where not having a rigorous enough process in terms of employment, you know, having one interview is not enough. You need to meet people 3, 4, sometimes 5 times. And we've got a global people function now where it's very rigorous and it's a process. And we find that we rarely get things wrong now. But in the early days, you know, it was just me making a final decision on someone. And, you know, I think sometimes when, I think it's easy to be sold to when you're moving quickly and you need to solve a problem and you think they're the right solution, you move too quickly. But my advice would be move slower when it comes to hiring. So, you know, I know this is a common saying, you know, hire slow, fire fast. But that would be, I think, the biggest lessons I've had along the way have been people related and getting that right, getting that early. Don't be in a rush, even though you're always in a rush as an entrepreneur, but that's the one thing you can't rush.
I love it. So, Paul, for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
They can hit me up on LinkedIn. My email is paul@songtrader.com. It's a pretty heavy inbox, but I try to answer everything I can which comes in.
Amazing. Well, hey, Paul, thank you so much for being on the show today. It has been an absolute honor to have you with us.
It's been a pleasure, and thank you for asking me on.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.